Welcome to Innovation in the Burg, a podcast about science and innovation in St. Petersburg. If you're a self-described science or technology geek, or even if you aren't, this will be a fun and informative conversation. I'm Allison Barlow, Executive Director of the St. Pete Innovation District. Each podcast, I'm joined by a local science or technology expert who will talk about what they're working on. But to make sure we keep this in perspective and don't become too technical, we have a community member joining us. Our hope is that you learn something new and enjoy our conversation. Let me introduce today's guest. Our expert is Laura Ingleby. She's with NOAA Fisheries. She's the Marine Mammal Branch Chief for the Southeast Regional Office. Also, our community member today is Lindsay Meyer. Lindsay's an intern with the Innovation District and as such got roped into this. She's a student at USF St. Petersburg, graduating this fall. So let me get started and ask Laura, tell us a little bit about your job. What exactly is it?
I have a great job. So I work with a great team of people, and we implement what's called the Marine Mammal Protection Act in the Southeast region. Our region goes from Texas through North Carolina. And so what we do is we work with a lot of other partners and states and agencies to conserve and protect marine mammals. And we do that by reducing bycatch in fisheries. We do that by ensuring that people are trained and able to respond to sick or injured or stranded dolphins and whales along the coastlines. And we generally just try to do everything we can to conserve marine mammal species because they're protected under law.
Interesting. Now, you've been in the news a lot because of a new species of whale, right?
That's right.
Kind of explain what's going on with that.
This is pretty exciting. One of our scientists at NOAA, Patty Roselle, is a geneticist. And she sort of stumbled across the fact that these whales called Brutus whales that live in the Gulf of Mexico, and we knew they lived there, but she kind of was wondering, how do they compare to other Brutus whales around the world? And if I step back for a minute, Brutus whales, why are they even called that?
Yeah, I was going to say that's an odd name. And I know it's spelled totally not like it sounds.
Well, I always used to call them bride's whales when I first saw it, right? But it's pronounced Brutus because they're named after Johan Brutus or something like that, Johan Brud. And he was a Norwegian whaler way back when. And so the whale's named after him.
Hmm.
And a lot of Brutus whales are named after people, which is kind of interesting. So anyway, that's how they got their name. They're named after a Norwegian whaler.
Okay.
So in any case, so Dr. Roselle sort of stumbled across this and started comparing samples from the whales in the Gulf of Mexico to other Brutus whales around the world and found out that they're genetically very distinct and that they are actually a subspecies, if not a species, of Brutus whales. And what's also exciting about this is that they are the only year-round baleen whale resident to the Gulf of Mexico. They live there all the time. A lot of people are familiar with other baleen whales, you know, the whales that don't have teeth but have the long baleen plates. A lot of people are familiar with like humpback whales and right whales, and a lot of those whales migrate seasonally. These whales, we believe, are there all the time in a very small area in the Gulf of Mexico. And it's about roughly 90 miles west of Tampa and about 26 miles south of Pensacola. And in this deep area from about 100, 400 meters is where they tend to inhabit. So it's a small area and a small number of whales.
How many whales is it?
Well, that's part of why they were just listed as endangered. There aren't very many. We estimate roughly less than 50, probably anywhere from 33 to 50 at best. They're now considered one of the most endangered whales in the world. And that sounds like that's dramatic, but it's true.
What makes them so endangered and like what's hurting
why are
them?
They? Yeah, it's a great question. They used to live more broadly in the Northern Gulf. And we know that from historic whaling records. And so we know they had a broader distribution and we're not entirely sure, but it could be the industrialization of the Gulf that has restricted their range. And that's basically where they live. But that's a really good question, one that we'll be certainly, you know, trying to understand a little bit more about.
And it's interesting, Lindsay and I were talking about in preparation for this, you know, the articles that we're talking about, the fact that the Smithsonian was here recently. Talk about a little bit what happened to cause that.
Yeah. So because this whale is so rare, I feel strangely, it's kind of mixed emotions, lucky and yet sad to have been to two different events where we've had Brutus whales strand. We had one here in Tampa. One Brutus whale came up on the bow of a ship. So it had been hit by a ship. It was a female who had had a calf. And so it was a really unfortunate situation. But we were able to collect a lot of data from that whale at Fort DeSoto. And so that was super interesting. That was in 2009. And the reason I'm telling you that is it's kind of an interesting story because when Patty realized this was a unique subspecies, she then went to search for a type specimen. And the reason she was interested in doing that was because this is a whale with no real name, right? We're calling it the Gulf of Mexico Bruce whales, but in taxonomy, this whale is going to have an official Latin name at some point in time. And in order for Patty to do that, she needs to find a type specimen, particularly of the skull, and to take various measurements, morphometrics, and have that exist to really seal the deal and name this species. So she couldn't find one anywhere in any collections.
Oh, interesting.
And so we remembered the whale in 2009, and we thought, well, let's dig it up.
Because it's buried at Fort DeSoto.
Right?
Okay.
So last year, we organized a big excavation of that female whale, the one from 2009. And the unfortunate part was that the whale had been soaking in water for many, many years, and the integrity of the skull just wasn't very good and had crumbled. However, a lot of the vertebrae, a lot of bones were taken for the Florida Natural History Museum. And so it was, you know, that was valuable, but it didn't meet what Patty was hoping for. And so then this past January, we had this Brutus whale strand in the Everglades National Park. And myself and all of our amazing colleagues from Florida Wildlife Research Institute were there for the necropsy, and we knew we had to get this skeleton. The Smithsonian was super excited, and everyone was excited, like, this can be the type specimen. But you have to imagine how logistically challenging it is to get a very large whale, you know, about almost, you know, between 35, 40 feet, you know, tens of thousands of pounds from the Everglades to the Smithsonian eventually.
Well, and this is the part that Lindsay and I are like, tell them what we talked about.
How did you get it from the Everglades to Fort DeSoto?
I mean, like, we came up with some ideas.
did you guys put it on a truck and just like trailer it up here?
That is exactly what we did. But that makes it sound easy. It was not. It was not easy. And a lot of people were working nonstop to make sure we could get the specimen. We didn't have a lot of time because I don't know if anyone's ever been to the Everglades, but we had worked with the National Park Service to tow the whale into Flamingo. And there's a boat ramp there that on the weekends, people like to come and go and put their boats in and out. And you can
imagine. You don't want to have a whale sitting there,
right? So all of our straining network partners were amazing. They worked just into the night. They were up there first thing in the morning, collecting as much data as they possibly could. And meanwhile, our NOAA straining coordinator, Blair Mays, was moving heaven and earth to pay and figure out how to pay for a giant truck to come and tow the whale. And so that's exactly what happened. We conducted the necropsy, and then this massive giant truck came, and we were able to, you know, basically pull the whale up onto this truck and drive it up to Fort DeSoto.
Like, is it a covered truck?
Yes.
I mean, I know.
Assuming there's,
I feel like
tarps.
We need legit details.
The whale was covered, so yes. I don't think people knew what they were driving by. Maybe the smell. Yeah, right? And then we had to organize logistics here to then bury the whale again. So we did that, and then the Smithsonian was trying to sort of get their ducks in a row to be able to come get the whale, which they did in early May. So we excavated this whale, and it's now been driven up to North Carolina, where it's been reburied in a bone graveyard for more sort of just having nature take its course so that you end up with just the bones and what have you. And then they'll dig it back up again and take it to the Smithsonian, where it will become the type specimen for the Gulf of Mexico Brutus whales. And eventually that whale will receive its due name, you know, that it well deserves.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So it was quite a feat. It's no small task, and it's a big animal.
Now, I assume the Smithsonian only gets involved, like, if it's a new species or something like this. They've already got samples of other animals.
Oh, my gosh, yes. I personally haven't toured it myself, but my colleagues have. I've talked to a couple people, actually just this past week, who have been through their collection, and it is amazing.
Really?
They've got specimens from all over the world, and it's quite a collection. They're not all on display, but they're archived for the long term. And it's really quite something, I'm told, and it's something I hope I get to go see at some point. But I hope to go see it when this whale is there. That would be full circle.
Yeah, totally. So then if everything goes as planned, then this will be designated a subspecies or a species or?
That's right. I mean, this whale already is a subspecies, okay. Genetically speaking. It's more of a formality to give it the Latin name and its official, to name the whale, essentially. And so that's a process. There has to be a scientific paper completed, and then it goes through the Marine Mammals Society for Marine Mammalogy Taxonomic Group, and they review the paper, and then they all decide and kind of bless it, and then it becomes, you know, there's all these rules that I don't even want to bore you with that I don't even remember all the details that Patty could rattle off very easily, but there's a lot of hoops one has to jump through, which makes sense to kind of standardize it. But it is a subspecies. That is a definite, but it just, you know, eventually it'll have its Latin name and maybe it'll be named, who knows?
I was going to ask you, do you get to name it?
Patty, being the biologist who discovered it, has a voice in that. And that's a pretty exciting thing for a scientist, and particularly a marine mammal scientist, because there aren't that many discoveries like this that occur.
That's so cool.
In our lifetime.
Yeah. We have Red Tide's Latin name is named after a local researcher, Karen Steininger. And so that's always cool. We'll have another one, hopefully.
Well, we'll
or
see.
Whatever she, you know.
She's giving it a lot of careful thought. And I think she has some good ideas about it. And then really the taxonomy group with the Society for Marine, The Society for Marine Mammalogy.
Well, it's kind of a long, involved title. You can say the Society. We kind of catch
society,
on.
The Society, they ultimately will, you know, make that final call. But yeah, no, it's a very, very exciting thing for her and for us and for marine mammal science.
Now, I'm curious. So, Lindsay, you're an environmental
science and policy major, yes.
Yeah. So, how did you get into this?
So, I'm older. So, what happened for me was I was watching a Jacques Cousteau special when I was about 13 or 14, where he was talking about spotted dolphins. And I just had one of these moments where I was just overtaken with, that's what I have to do with my life. That's just what I'm going to do. And so, I just didn't give that up. And so, I went away to college and picked the very appropriate major of geology, I might add, but that's another story. So during summers, you know, you're looking for work, right? And I lived in Atlanta, Georgia. And so I thought, I've got to find dolphins somewhere near here. And at the time, we didn't have the internet. None of that existed. So I didn't really know what jobs there were with marine mammals. I had no idea. And so I thought, well, the dolphins closest to me are at Six Flags over Georgia. Mm-hmm. So I went there and I knocked on their door and I said, I'm here to work with your dolphins. And they're like, great. And, you know, they put me in rides. And so I would just go to the dolphin display every day and talk to the people that worked there. And then they had an opening for crowd control. So I was super excited. So then they said, oh, no, we don't allow people to go from rides to shows. You can't do that. And no, we can't allow you to work there, even if they have an opening. So I thought, that's not right. So I sat in the director's office and I waited for him to come in. And when he came in, I said, this is my career. This is my life. You have to let me transfer. And he did.
Wow.
And so then I swept up cigarette butts and
hey, you got to put in your time. You do.
Eventually, smoking was a lot more frequent then. Anyhow, so then I ended up becoming an assistant dolphin trainer there. And there was a number on our fish house wall of a place in the Florida Keys. And so out of college, I got a job working with dolphins in the Florida Keys. And then that kind of kicked off a long-term interest. And eventually I realized my real passion was to want to try to get into science policy and management. And right now, this is my dream job. This was the job that I had wanted my entire career. And so to be here is just absolutely fantastic. But that's how it started. It was really Jacques Cousteau and some people along the way really inspiring that.
That's amazing.
So, yeah. Yeah.
Because how did you get interested, Lindsay?
Well, I've lived in St. Pete my entire life and my family had a sailboat and we used to go sailing all the time and always on the water, always out and about, like doing things, been to the Florida Keys multiple times. And I just love the water, love the environment. It's just such like a serene place to be in and just feel like all your worries just kind of float away. And like, you want to keep it that perfect, I don't know the word, like condition that it's in and like
sure.
All the wildlife and everything. It just, I don't know, it makes me happy and I'm passionate about it. And I want to do anything I can to protect it and save it and I don't know. I just love it.
Yeah, that's, and I think your passion is why I love my job so much, because I get to work with people just like you every day. We're all so passionate. And I think the ocean, and in particular, marine mammals, but honestly, corals and turtles and other, you know, fish, all the biologists they're involved in are really passionate about what they do. And that's what makes this feel really exciting to be in, because you're just working with so many people that have your same sort of interest and excitement.
And what, like, resources, is there a blog you follow, you know, a newspaper, or what kinds of things for people who are considering this as a field would you suggest?
That's a really good question for people who are pursuing careers.
Yeah, or just interest.
Marine mammal science, or all the things I wish I had known when I was in college.
Yeah, maybe that would be.
Yeah, I mean, because I didn't know. I honestly didn't know there were careers with NOAA. I had no idea. I had to sort of figure that out. I think there is a listserv called MarMam, and for people interested in marine mammals, and that listserv basically, every day, it sort of lists different opportunities for people. So that's a really good thing. There are certain colleges and universities that have marine science, marine mammal programs. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of great folks in our field that have come from USF. I mean, USF has an outstanding marine science program. So basically, I think it's following the part of marine science that drives you and inspires you. Like, what are you super interested in? And then finding the researchers that are working on that, and then pursuing them. And that's exactly what I did. I would go to professional conferences like the Society for Marine Mammalogy. They have conferences every other year. I would go to those. I would be inspired by a certain speaker, and I would go up to them after and talk to them and say, you know, how can I work with you? How can I be an intern with you? How can I do more? And I would get experience with them in an internship. And sometimes you'd have to pay for those internships.
Right.
But then you get the experience. And once you open up one door, then another one opens, and then you make another connection, and so on and so forth. So I don't know if that answered your
question.
Totally
did. Because I always want to sort of tie it back, because people will listen to this.
Sure.
And they might have an interest. One other question I had for you is, if you don't mind, because I think we touched on it at the beginning of the conversation, but NOAA itself and what NOAA does. Because honestly, we all know the hurricane hunters.
Oh, yeah.
And we know the weather report. But tell people why NOAA is involved in this.
Oh, sure. When most people think of NOAA, they think of the Weather Service. And we are a part of NOAA that's called the Fisheries Service, NOAA Fisheries Service.
Okay.
And so in a nutshell, what we do is promote sustainable fisheries, safe seafood, and conserve and recover protected species like marine mammals and sea turtles and other endangered species like sawfish and things like that. And then also another important mission of NOAA is to not only protect those species, but to protect those habitats that they live within. And achieving all of that while balancing it with enhancing economic opportunities. So that's sort of the overarching mission of what we do in NOAA. Sustainability, sustainable fisheries, sustainable ecosystems, protected species, and all balancing that with improving the economy.
And it's really interesting because you're physically here locally in St. Pete in the old power building.
Right.
Right on Bayboro Harbor. And then around the harbor is the College of Marine Science from USF that you mentioned. You mentioned Florida Fish and Wildlife.
That's right.
You know, I think even in your building is Tampa Bay Estuary. So the partners right there are pretty amazing.
We're in this epicenter of incredible marine scientists. And USGS is across the street, right?
U.S. Geological Survey and coastal mapping part.
That's right. Yeah. And so it's, St. Pete is sort of a mecca, in my opinion, for marine science. And so it's very exciting to have all of these people within walking distance and to be able to collaborate with them. And to have USF right down the road too is really wonderful.
Yeah, because it's interesting. I know it's all under the umbrella of the ocean team.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is, on any given situation, like you were talking about with the whale, you had partners from the get-go at the scene from all these different, and you guys are coordinating quite a bit.
Yeah, a lot of what we do in my job in particular with our marine mammal group is we have a huge area to cover and we need partners to help achieve our ultimate mission, which we share with our partners, right? I mean, our partners are just as passionate about protecting the marine environment. And so it's all about trying to create a network where we're all working together for common goals. And so that's a lot of what we do. And so we rely on that very heavily and value it immensely. And we couldn't do it without all of these tremendous people here in Florida, but in all the other states in the Southeast as well.
So who inspires you in science?
That's a great question. This is going to sound really corny, and I'm just going to say it super corny, but honestly, the people I work with on a regular basis, inside and outside the agency, in my job, I'm able to work with some of the best marine mammal scientists in the world. And that is very inspiring on a daily basis. Some of them are, you know, in our office, some of them are, you know, over in the UK, but, you know, nonetheless, that inspires me on a regular basis. But there's three people that really inspire me in a bigger sense. And one of them is Sylvia Earle, right?
Okay, yeah.
And Sylvia Earle was the first female, and it's women scientists there, I think I find particularly inspiring because mm-hmm. it's a tough field, or it historically was, and that's really changing dramatically. But Sylvia Earle was the first female NOAA chief scientist, but she has quite a history. She's logged 7,000 hours underwater. She's the only person that's walked depths of over 1,000 feet in the gym suit off of Hawaii. She's done extraordinary things, but what really inspires me about Sylvia Earle, and I've had the great fortune to scuba dive with her a couple times, is she is so knowledgeable and articulate and passionate. And she is one of these people, when you go hear her speak, she will change your view in some shape or form. So she's inspiring, and it's all based on her own observations and her tremendous also love of everything in the sea. So she's a huge inspiration. Catherine Sullivan's another inspiration. She was also a NOAA chief scientist at one point. She also was the administrator of NOAA at one point, but she was a female astronaut. She was the first American woman to walk in space. And the things that inspire me about her are her leadership and her ability to pull a lot of teams together for a common mission and think strategically and efficiently and really intelligently about kind of getting work done. So her leadership inspires me, right?
Right. It's important to have that element with the research and the scientific technology, but you need the leadership.
That's exactly right. And so that's really inspired me. And then recently, I'd say the most mind-blowing talk I've been to was by Dr. Tracy Sutton, who was a graduate of USF.
Oh.
He is now at Nova Southeastern, and he runs the Deep End Consortium studying deep sea animals in the Gulf of Mexico. I have seen him give two lectures, and each time my mind was absolutely blown by what he had to say. His leadership skills of pulling together all of these entities to kind of answer fundamental questions about species that we have never explored in the Gulf of Mexico is phenomenal. And just one kind of tidbit of that is after Deepwater Horizon oil spill, his team went out to sort of do a census of species out there. They discovered 800 species in the deep Gulf of Mexico. And deep Gulf of Mexico is like, you know, roughly, you know, 600 meters plus, or maybe I'm messing that up, but it's deep. It's really, really, really deep.
We'll go with that.
And they documented 800 species, and like over 100 of them were new and had never been documented there before. And then they discovered some new species entirely. I think something called like a snaggletooth dragonfish, or I don't know, something like that. It's incredible the discoveries they're making, and the work they're doing is finding out that the Gulf of Mexico is one of the most diverse ecosystems out there. And no one's looked before, and they're just doing some amazing work. Because when you think about the Gulf, you look at it, my husband doesn't like it because it doesn't have waves and he wants to go surfing or, you know, whatever. And you look and it's just sort of this big piece of water, but there's so much diversity under there and he will blow your mind. So he's been very inspiring to me lately.
That's fascinating, because I've heard some of the folks locally who are involved in the Deepwater Horizon analysis and sort of following it. And they've said one of the most interesting things was they didn't have baseline data before the accident.
That's right.
And so they are now getting it and trying to anticipate what was caused by the accident, as well as let's get a baseline now before an eventual unfortunate accident will probably happen again in their eyes.
That's exactly right. And this consortium of multiple entities is trying to do just that for the deep sea part. And the other thing too is, you know, you don't think about it, but the deep part of the Gulf of Mexico is roughly about, you know, maybe 90% of the Gulf of Mexico. Right. So it's very understudied. And so it's really exciting stuff.
Well, we always talk about coming off the coastline in Florida. It's a long shelf.
That's right.
And then it drops off. Right. But so there's a lot of focus on the fact that there's this long shelf. And so that makes a lot of sense that people just haven't ventured into the middle very often.
That's right. And the discoveries they're finding and how that affects all of us in some shape or form are really, really inspiring.
So back to the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, did any like Brutus whales get affected by that? Like tying that all back to the Brutus whale, like were they affected by that at all? Like that you guys saw of?
Because they live so far offshore, we weren't able to document, you know, a Brutus whale in oil per se. However, where they live overlapped with the oil spill footprint. and our scientists, through work they did by looking at the more studied bottlenose dolphins that were exposed to oil, basically did some calculations and identified that probably, based on what we know from how bottlenose dolphins were affected, that likely 48% of the Bruce whales and affected their reproduction as well. So yes, we suspect it absolutely had an impact on those whales, but we didn't happen to document any whales just because of where they live.
That's an interesting question, because when you talk about the oil fields in the Gulf of Mexico, it sounds like they overlap with where the Brutus whales live.
That's right.
So that's going to be a big issue.
Yeah, it's one of the biggest threats to Brutus whales is all the activities associated with oil and gas exploration, as well as oil spills and our response to oil spills, as well as noise and vessel strikes and some fishery impacts. So those are the big threats to them that we have to start working on. Yeah.
Another question I had about the Brutus whale, again, wrapping it, like tying it all back to the beginning. What makes the Gulf of Mexico Brutus whale so different, or like more of that different species than the ones that are found around the world?
I am not a geneticist. All I can tell you is, if we had Patty here, we could rattle that off. So I'm not sure I can explain in great detail, but basically she looked at like 23 samples from the Brutus whales here in the Gulf and compared them to like 500 samples. And they're just basically, when you look at their DNA, you know, they're just on this very distinct lineage that is very different than the others. But I'm not a geneticist, so I can't give you, yeah. I'd be happy to get back to you, and I can send you her paper actually, so that you can read that, because there's a much better answer than the one I'm giving you, but I'm not a geneticist.
But
so
the idea that it's at the genetic level, not at the physical, like if I saw them, I wouldn't notice a difference.
That's correct.
Interesting.
And what's also interesting about them is they have unique calls in the Gulf of Mexico that are unique to other Brutus whales. Our NOAA scientists have documented two, and they're studying two other calls, but they've definitely identified two unique calls to the Brutus whales in the Gulf. So they have their unique voice, as well as their unique genetics.
That's so cool. Whales are awesome.
whales are super interesting. They're super interesting. And they, Brutus whales in the Gulf of Mexico in particular, have some of the longest calls of baleen whales. Their calls can last anywhere from 15 to 45 seconds. And a blue whale's lasts maybe 30 seconds. And minke whales are the longest. They can last up to 60. But their calls are very long in the Gulf of Mexico. So yeah, there's a lot to learn about them. And when they feed, they sort of dive down to the bottom and they lunge feed towards the bottom. And then at night, we know from tagging a small number of whales that they spend a lot of their time near the surface at night, which puts them at risk to vessel strikes and things like that. But they then dive down and feed at the lower levels.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, if you can believe it, we're out of time. It goes so fast. If folks want to learn more information or any places, calls to action that you have from NOAA?
Yeah, I think really simply, if folks go to NOAA.gov, NOAA.gov, then they'll be able to find their way to NOAA Fisheries and our marine mammal program, or it's as simple as putting the search engine, marine mammals, NOAA Fisheries, and or Brutus whales, NOAA Fisheries, and you'll get to our site.
And will you spell Brutus? Because it is that oddly spelled.
Absolutely. It's capital B. R-Y-D-E apostrophe S.
And then you mentioned before we got started today, there is a phone number if somebody sees something.
Absolutely. If anyone ever sees any dolphin or whale that's injured and distressed, stranded, dead or alive, to call 1-877-WHALE-HELP.
Perfect. I want to thank our guests for joining us today. Also, let folks listening know, if you want more details on any of this and also to learn about the other podcasts, check out stpeteinnovationdistrict.com. And we will be having some great events coming in the fall. So thanks for listening and have a great day.